Chapter 19. Rome, the Republic. The phrase, the children of robbers, exactly defines the people of Rome. When, after the death of Remus, Romulus found the number of his fellow settlers too small, he opened an asylum on the Capitoline Hill, and all manner of people, thieves, murderers, and vagabonds of every kind flocked thither. Such was the origin of Rome, the city of strength and war and bloodshed, this city which was destined to shed more blood than any other city of the world has done. The most of these, if not all, were of course men, but in order that they might become a nation, there must be women. To secure these, Romulus asked those in the neighboring cities to unite themselves by marriages to his people. Everywhere they refused with contempt, saying to him, "Open an asylum for women too." Then Romulus had recourse to a stratagem, proclaiming that he had discovered the altar of Consus, the god of counsels, an allegory of his cunning in general. In the midst of the solemnities, the Sabine maidens, 30 in number, were carried off. From this rape, there arose wars, first with the neighboring towns, which were defeated one after another, and at last with the Sabines. Between the Palatine and the Tarpeian Rock, a battle was fought in which neither party gained a decisive victory, until the Sabine women threw themselves between the combatants, who agreed that henceforth sovereignty should be divided between the Romans and the Sabines. According to the annals, this happened in the fourth year of Rome, which, as Rome was founded 753 BC, would be in 750 BC. Rome comes into this history and into the affairs of the East through Macedonia and Greece. And in order clearly to state this, we must return to the point where we left the history of Macedonia. It will be remembered that Pyrrhus, by the desertion of his army to Lysimachus, was obliged to resign all claims to Macedonia and retire to his own country of Epirus. Shortly after he had returned thus to his own country, 281 BC, there came to him ambassadors from Tarentum and from all the Greeks in Italy, bearing to him the invitation to become their general and lead them in war against the Romans. They promised that the Tarentines, the Lucanians, the Samnites, and the Messapians would bring into the field 370,000 troops. Pyrrhus accepted the invitation and immediately, as an evidence of good faith, sent 3,000 of his own troops across to Tarentum. The Tarentines then sent over ships to transport to Italy the rest of the army that he would take with him, 25,000 men. On account of a violent storm, he was driven to the coast of the Messapians, where he was obliged to land. The troops of the Messapians at once joined him, and he marched to Tarentum, where was to be the rendezvous of his whole army. Before the promised troops of his allies had come to him, he learned that a powerful army of the Romans was marching against him. Pyrrhus sent a herald to ask the Romans whether they would accept him as arbiter between them and the Greeks in Italy. They replied, "The Romans neither take Pyrrhus as arbiter nor fear him as an enemy." A battle was fought, 280 BC, near Heraclea in Italy, in which the Romans were defeated with the loss of 15,000 men, Pyrrhus himself losing 13,000. Pyrrhus next sent an ambassador to Rome to offer peace, but the Romans refused to receive any communication from him or to listen to any single proposition of his until he should have left Italy. A second battle was fought, 279 BC, near Osculum, in which Pyrrhus was again victorious, but with such great loss that when one of his officers congratulated him on the victory, Pyrrhus, with grim humor, replied, "If we gain such another, we are inevitably ruined." While Pyrrhus was wondering what he should do next and how he could get out of Italy with honor, an embassy arrived from Sicily, offering to him Syracuse, their capital city, and also other cities, if he would help them to drive out the Carthaginians from the island of Sicily. Just at the time also, messengers arrived from Greece, conveying to him that news of the death of Seleucus Soranus, and offering to him the throne of Macedonia. Pyrrhus accepted the offer of the Sicilians, and at once embarked his army and sailed to Sicily. The Sicilians delivered to him the promised cities as soon as he landed, and he soon so gained the hearts of the people and made himself so powerful that the Carthaginians asked for peace upon the condition that they might be allowed to retain in Sicily only the one city of Lilybaeum. Pyrrhus felt himself so secure that he not only refused to grant this request for peace, but even proposed to make an expedition against Carthage. He had a sufficient fleet to do this, but not enough sailors. To secure the necessary sailors, he levied a draft of men on all the cities of Sicily, and punished the cities that would not furnish their quota. This caused great dissatisfaction to the people of Sicily, and as Pyrrhus pushed his exactions, he finally drove the Sicilians into a league with the Carthaginians and the Mamertines against him. However, just at this juncture, the Tarentines and Samnites sent word to him that they were shut up in their cities and were surely lost unless he came to the rescue. He started immediately. He was obliged to fight the Carthaginians as he was leaving the harbor of Syracuse, and the Mamertines as soon as he landed in Italy. He was successful, however, at both points, and reaching Tarentum with 23,000 men, marched against the Romans and met them in Samnium, near the city of Beneventum. This time the Romans were successful, and Pyrrhus was compelled to return to Epirus, which left all Italy subject to Rome, B.C. 274. The reputation of the Romans beginning now to spread through foreign nations by the war they had maintained for 6 years against Pyrrhus, whom at length they compelled to retire from Italy and return ignominiously to Epirus, Ptolemy Philadelphus sent ambassadors to desire their friendship, and the Romans were charmed to find it solicited by so great a king. The following year the Romans sent to Egypt 4 ambassadors in return for this courtesy from Philadelphus. In the year 263 BC began the First Punic War, which continued 24 years. The Punic Wars, which were 3 in number, were wars of the Romans against the Carthaginians. The reason these were called Punic Wars is that Carthage was founded by Dido of Tyre, the great-granddaughter of the father of Jezebel. Thus the city was a Phoenician colony, and the Western pronunciation of the word for Phoenician turned it into Punic. The Punic Wars were, in short, simply a contest of 118 years at intervals between Rome and Carthage to decide which should have the dominion of the world. Illyria, on the eastern coast of the Adriatic Sea, was held by petty kings who lived by piracy. The chief authority in Illyria in B.C. 228 was a certain Teuda, widow of Agron. The Romans sent an embassy to Teuda, complaining of these piracies. Teuda killed one of the ambassadors, upon which the Romans declared war against her, invaded Illyria, and conquered all the country. Peace was made upon a treaty in which Teuda was allowed the possession of but a few towns, was compelled to pay tribute to Rome, and was not to sail beyond the city of Lysias with more than two vessels, and these unarmed. This brought the Romans into so great favor with the Greeks that when they sent to acquaint the Greeks with the subjugation of Illyria, their ambassadors were welcomed, and the Corinthians made a public decree that the Romans should be admitted to the Isthmian Games on an equality with the Greeks. Athens gave them the freedom of their city and initiated them into the great mysteries. This was the first instance of any recognition of the Roman power in Greece. Antigonus Gonatas, the son of Demetrius, the son of Antiochus, the general of Alexander, died in the year 242 BC, and was succeeded by his son Demetrius, who reigned 10 years. This Demetrius died in BC 232, leaving as his successor his son Philip. But Philip, being a child, he was committed to the guardianship of Antigonus Dawson, who filled the office of regent until 221 BC, when, he dying, the scepter was bestowed upon Philip at the age of 14 years, and at about the same time that Philopater ascended the throne of Egypt. In the year 217 BC, the Romans were defeated by Hannibal of Carthage at Lake Thrasymenus in Italy. When this news reached Macedonia, it was decided in council that Philip should go into Italy and join Hannibal in war upon the Romans, because that in case he should suffer the storm which was gathering in the west to burst upon Greece, it was very much to be feared that it would then be no longer in their power to take up arms, to treat of peace, nor to determine their affairs in a manner agreeable to themselves, or as they might judge most expedient. This is the first time that the affairs of Italy and Africa influence those of Greece and direct their motions. After this, neither Philip nor the other powers of Greece regulated their conduct when they were to make peace or war by the state of their respective countries, but directed all their views and attention toward Italy. The Asiatics and the inhabitants of the islands did the same soon after. All those who, from that time, had reasons to be dissatisfied with the conduct of Philip or Attalus, no longer addressed Antiochus or Ptolemy for protection. They no longer turned their eyes to the south or east, but fixed them upon the west. In accordance with the advice of the council, Philip sent ambassadors into Italy to find Hannibal and make an alliance with him. The ambassadors fell into the hands of the Romans, but pretending that they were sent to make an alliance with the Romans, they disarmed suspicion and escaped. They then went straight to Hannibal and accomplished their mission. But as they were making their way back, accompanied by ambassadors from Hannibal, and bearing the treaty of alliance that had been formed, they were again captured by the Romans. The whole plot was discovered, and the ambassadors were all carried to Rome and held there. By this mishap, Philip was obliged to send another embassy to Hannibal, which was successful in reaching Macedonia again with a copy of the Treaty of Alliance. Thus 2 years were lost by Philip, besides the disadvantage of having the Romans discover his plans. In the winter of 216-215 B.C., Philip built a fleet with which to cross the Adriatic, gathered together his army, and in the spring started for Italy, but turned aside to seize some cities on the coast of Epirus. The Roman commander at Brundusium, learning of this, embarked with a considerable force, sailed across to Epirus, recovered a city which Philip had already taken, and sent succor to another which he was then besieging. By a night march, the Romans were enabled completely to surprise Philip's army and inflict upon it such a defeat that even Philip himself barely escaped to his ships, and was even compelled to burn these to keep them from being captured by the Romans. He then returned by land to Macedonia. In the year 211 BC, Greece and Macedonia were allotted by the Senate to the Roman praetor, Valerius Levinus, as his province. Levinus persuaded the Aetolians to break their league with Philip and ally themselves with the Romans, making great promises upon their being the first people of the East formally to join the Romans. The treaty was made accordingly. The next year, Levinus was made consul in Rome. He was succeeded in Greece and Macedonia by Sulpidius, who, in 208 BC, with Attalus, king of Pergamus, with a fleet, joined the Aetolians, who were now certain to be attacked by Philip. The allied forces were put under the command of Pyrrhus, but Philip defeated them twice and shut them up in Lamia. Soon after this, while Philip was presiding at the Nemean Games at Argos, he received the news that Sulpidius was laying waste all the country between Sicyon and Corinth. He left the games and took the command of his army, met Sulpidius, and put him to flight, and returned to his place at the games. After the games were over, Philip marched into Elis, where he was defeated by Sulpidius. Then, learning that the barbarians had made an incursion into Macedonia, he returned to his own country. Upon this, Sulpidius and Attalus ravaged eastern Greece. Just at this time, the war with Carthage, the Second Punic War, so engrossed the attention of the Romans that for 2 years nothing special was done by them in Greece, and the Aetolians, for their own safety, concluded a peace with Philip. About the time, however, when they had settled this matter, Sempronius, a Roman general, arrived in Aetolia with 11,000 troops and was much offended to find that the Aetolians had made peace. But the affair with Carthage was so absorbing to the Romans that Sempronius himself decided it best to accommodate matters so as to conclude a general peace with Philip, 204 BC. The very next year it was, 203 BC, that Philip and Antiochus Magnus joined themselves together to rob the infant Ptolemy of his dominions. Magnus succeeded in taking all the countries up to the frontiers of Egypt. Philip made an attempt upon both Rhodes and Pergamus, but these two powers joined themselves together against him and defeated him with a slaughter of about 12,000 of his troops. He then destroyed Syos, a city of Bithynia, and received the submission of some cities in Thrace and the Chersonesus, and laid siege to the city of Abydos on the Asiatic side of the Hellespont. During the time in which these events occurred, Rome had defeated Carthage and ended the Second Punic War. The guardians of young Ptolemy, learning of this, sent an embassy to Rome to ask the Romans to protect them against Magnus and Philip. At this same time, the Rhodians and Attalus of Pergamus also sent an embassy to Rome to complain against Magnus and Philip. Rome promptly responded and immediately sent three ambassadors, 201 BC. The three traveled together to Rhodes. From there, one of them, Emilius, went to Philip at Abydos, and in the name of the Senate and people of Rome, commanded Philip to stop the siege of that place and submit to arbitration his differences with Attalus and others, or else the Romans would make war on him. Philip began to justify himself, but Emilius interrupted him with the question, "Did the Athenians and the Abidenians attack you first?" This was a boldness of speech that Philip had never met before, and it angered him, and he replied, "Your age, your beauty, and especially the Roman name, exalt your pride to a prodigious degree. For my part, I wish your republic may observe punctually the treaties it has concluded with me. But in case I shall be invaded by it, I hope to show that the Empire of Macedonia does not yield to Rome either in valor or reputation." Emilius was obliged to depart with this answer. Philip continued his siege until he had captured the city of Abydos, in which he placed a strong garrison. He then returned to Macedonia. Emilius went direct from Philip to Egypt, and in the name of the Senate and people of Rome assumed the guardianship of the young Ptolemy, pursuant to the instructions he had received from the Senate at his setting out. Philip paid no attention to the demands of Rome, but invaded and laid waste all Attica, and returned home laden with spoils. The Athenians sent off an embassy at once to Rome to make complaint. At Rome, the ambassadors of Athens were joined by those of Rhodes and King Attalus, and the three parties presented together their complaints against Philip. While the Senate was deliberating upon these complaints, a second embassy arrived from Athens with the word that Philip was upon the point of invading Attica the second time, and that if help was not speedily sent, he would surely capture Athens. The Senate also at the same time received letters from their commanders in Greece to the effect that they were in danger of being attacked by Philip, and that the danger being imminent, they had no time to lose. Upon all these pleas, the Romans declared war against Philip, 200 BC, and at once sent Sulpicius, the consul, with a fleet and an army. By this time Philip had invaded Attica, and one portion of his army was actually besieging Athens, while he with the rest of the army had marched against Attalus and the Rhodians. The Roman fleet arrived at the Piraeus just in time to save Athens. Nothing further of note was accomplished during the next 2 years. At the beginning of the year 198 BC, Antiochus Magnus attacked Attalus, king of Pergamus, by both sea and land. Attalus at once sent ambassadors to Rome, asking either that the Romans should send a force to help him, or else allow him to recall his troops that were being used in behalf of the Romans in Greece. The Senate sent an embassy to Magnus, to whose remonstrances he listened, and immediately drew away all his forces from the territory of Attalus. Aristomenes, whom the Romans had appointed guardian of the young king of Egypt, had recovered from Magnus Palestine and Phoenicia. Magnus now led his army to take these countries again for himself. In this he was completely successful, and that he might retain these countries in quietness, he made a proposition that if the young Ptolemy would marry his daughter Cleopatra as soon as they were both old enough, he would give back to Egypt those provinces as the dowry of his daughter. This proposal was accepted, and a treaty was concluded accordingly. In this same year, 198 BC, Titus Quintius Flamininus received the allotment of Macedonia as his province, and with his brother Lucius to command his fleet, he started at once to Macedonia. Upon his arrival in Epirus, he found the Roman army encamped between Epirus and Illyria in the presence of Philip's army, Philip holding all the passes. Philip made proposals of peace, but terms could not be agreed upon, and the war went on. Finally, some shepherds came to Flamininus and offered to lead him by a path over the mountains to the rear of the Macedonian forces. This plan succeeded. Philip was badly defeated and marched into Macedonia. Flamininus was continued in command in Macedonia for the year 197 BC. Attalus of Pergamus, in pleading with the Boeotians to join the Romans and their allies, overexerted himself and died shortly afterward. About the same time, the Achaean League joined Rome. Flamininus defeated Philip twice and then concluded a peace, 196 BC, because Antiochus Magnus was then about to cross the Hellespont to the aid of Philip, and Flamininus did not want to meet both of these powerful commanders at once. It was now the time in which the Isthmian Games were to be solemnized, and the expectation of what was there to be transacted had drawn thither an incredible multitude of people and persons of the highest rank. The conditions of the Treaty of Peace, which were not yet entirely made public, formed the topic of all conversation, and various opinions were entertained concerning them. But very few could be persuaded that the Romans would evacuate all the cities they had taken. All Greece was in this uncertainty when, the multitude being assembled in the stadium to see the games, a herald comes forward and publishes with a loud voice, "The Senate and people of Rome and Titus Quintius the general, having overcome Philip and the Macedonians, set at liberty from all garrisons and taxes and imposts, the Corinthians, the Locrians, the Phocians, the Euboeans, the Phaiot Achaeans, the Magnesians, the Thessalians, and the Perebians, declare them free and ordain that they shall be governed by their respective laws and usages." At these words, which many heard but imperfectly because of the noise that interrupted them, all the spectators were filled with excess of joy. They gazed upon and questioned one another with astonishment, and could not believe either their eyes or ears. So like a dream was what they then saw and heard. It was thought necessary for the herald to repeat the proclamation, which was now listened to with the most profound silence, so that not a single word of the decree was lost. And now, fully assured of their happiness, they abandoned themselves again to the highest transports of joy and broke into such loud and repeated acclamations that the sea resounded with them at a great distance, and some ravens which happened to fly that instant over the assembly fell down in the stadium. So true it is that of all the blessings of this life, none are so dear to mankind as liberty. The games and sports were hurried over without any attention being paid to them, for so great was the general joy upon this occasion that it extinguished all other sentiments. The games being ended, all the people ran in crowds to the Roman general, and everyone being eager to see his deliverer, to salute him, to kiss his hand, and to throw crowns and festoons of flowers over him, he would have run the hazard of being pressed to death by the crowd, had not the vigor of his years, for he was not above 33 years old, and the joy which so glorious a day gave him, sustained and enabled him to undergo the fatigue of it. The remembrance of so delightful a day, and of the valuable blessings then bestowed, was continually renewed, and for a long time formed the only subject of conversation at all times and in all places. Everyone cried in the highest transports of admiration and a kind of enthusiasm that there was a people in the world who, at their own expense and the hazard of their lives, engaged in a war for the liberty of other nations, and that not for their neighbors or people situated on the same continent, but who crossed seas and sailed to distant climes to destroy and extirpate unjust power from the earth and to establish universally law, equity, and justice. That by a single word and the voice of a herald, liberty had been restored to all the cities of Greece and Asia. That a great soul only could have formed such a design, but that to execute it was the effect at once of the highest good fortune and the most consummate virtue. They called to mind all the great battles which Greece had fought for the sake of liberty. After sustaining so many wars, said they, never was its valor crowned with so blessed a reward as when strangers came and took up arms in its defense. It was then that almost without shedding a drop of blood, or losing scarce one man, it acquired the greatest and noblest of all prizes for which mankind can contend. Valor and prudence are rare at all times, but of all virtues, justice is most rare. Agesilaus, Lysander, Nicias, and Alcibiades had great abilities for carrying on war and gaining battles both by sea and land. But then it was for themselves and their country, not for strangers and foreigners, they fought. That height of glory was reserved for the Romans. But the gratitude which the Greeks showed Flamininus and the Romans did not terminate merely in causing them to be praised. It also infinitely conduced to the augmentation of their power by inducing all nations to confide in them and rely on the faith of their engagements. For they not only received such generals as the Romans sent them, but requested earnestly that they might be sent. They called them in and put themselves into their hands with joy. And not only nations and cities, but princes and kings, who had complaints to offer against the injustice of neighboring powers, had recourse to them, and put themselves in a manner under their safeguard, so that in a short time, from an effect of the divine protection, to use Plutarch's expression, the whole earth submitted to their empire. As we have seen, this peace was made with Philip because Magnus was on his way from the east to aid Philip, and the Romans would not risk a war with the two powers united. This was in 196 BC. Magnus had taken possession of Ephesus and several other cities in Asia Minor, and Smyrna and Lampsacus, with some other cities, fearing his designs upon them, applied to the Romans for protection. The Romans saw plainly that it was their interest to check the progress of Antiochus toward the west, and how fatal the consequences would be should they suffer him to extend his power by settling on the coast of Asia, according to the plan he had laid down. They were therefore very glad of the opportunity those free cities gave them of opposing it, and immediately sent an embassy to him. While this was going on, Magnus had sent troops and begun the siege of both Smyrna and Lampsacus, while he himself, with the great body of his army, had crossed the Hellespont and possessed himself of all the Thracian Chersonesus. There also he began rebuilding the city of Lysimachia, with the design of making it the capital of a kingdom for his son, which he would establish on the west of the Hellespont. At Celimbria in Thrace, the Roman ambassadors found Magnus. They, by their spokesman, L. Cornelius, required Antiochus to restore to Ptolemy the several cities in Asia which he had taken from him, to evacuate all those which had been possessed by Philip, it not being just that he should reap the fruits of the war which the Romans had carried on against that prince, and not to molest such of the Grecian cities of Asia as enjoyed their liberty. He added that the Romans were greatly surprised at Antiochus for crossing into Europe with two such numerous armies and so powerful a fleet, and for rebuilding Lysimachia, an undertaking which could have no other view but to invade them. To all this Antiochus answered that Ptolemy should have full satisfaction when his marriage, which was already concluded, should be solemnized, that with regard to such Grecian cities as desired to retain their liberties, it was from him and not from the Romans they were to receive them. With respect to Lysimachia, he declared that he rebuilt it with the design of making it the residence of Seleucus his son, that Thrace and the Chersonesus, which was part of it, belonged to him, that they had been conquered from Lysimachus by Seleucus Nicator, one of his ancestors, and that he came thither as into his own patrimony. As to Asia and the cities he had taken there from Philip, he knew not what right the Romans could have to them, and therefore he desired them to interfere no further in the affairs of Asia than he did with those of Italy. The Romans desiring that the ambassadors of Smyrna and Lampsacus might be called in, they accordingly were admitted. They spoke with so much freedom as incensed Antiochus to that degree that he cried in a passion that the Romans had no business to judge of those affairs. Upon this, the assembly broke up in great disorder. None of the parties received satisfaction, and everything seemed to tend to an open rupture. Just at this time, Magnus received a report that young Ptolemy was dead, and leaving his son Seleucus in Thrace, he himself took his fleet and started to Egypt to take possession. The report was false, but the promptness of Antiochus to act upon it and attempt to seize Egypt caused the Romans to be more determined than before to prevent his gaining a permanent foothold on the west of the Hellespont. Accordingly, when the Roman commissioners, who had settled the affairs of Greece, returned to Rome in 195 BC, they told their Senate that they must expect and prepare for a new war, which would be still more dangerous than they had just before terminated, that Antiochus had crossed into Europe with a strong army and a considerable fleet, that upon a false report which had been spread concerning Ptolemy's death, he had set out in order to possess himself of Egypt, and that otherwise he would have made Greece the seat of the war, that the Aetolians, a people naturally restless and turbulent and ill-affected to Rome, would certainly rise on that occasion, that Greece fostered in its own bosom a tyrant, Nabus, more avaricious and cruel than any of his predecessors, who was mediating now to enslave it, and that thus having been restored in vain to its liberty by the Romans, it would only change its sovereign, and would fall under a more grievous captivity than before, especially if Nabus should continue in possession of the city of Argos. Flamininus was commanded to be particularly vigilant with respect to all the movements of Antiochus. This was made the more necessary just now by the arrival of Hannibal at the court of Antiochus to claim his protection. Hannibal had done this because the Romans were about to require the Carthaginians to deliver him up to them to prevent his making an alliance with Antiochus. They feared that if Hannibal and Antiochus should unite, they would carry the war into Italy itself. Antiochus was delighted at the arrival of Hannibal, the inveterate enemy of the Romans, the greatest general of the age, and one of the greatest of any age. He therefore definitely resolved on a war with Rome, and began his preparations, which, in fact, were much protracted. In the year 193 BC, the marriage between Ptolemy and the daughter of Antiochus was solemnized according to the treaty which had been made to that effect. The preparations for war were steadily continued, Hannibal all the time urging that the war should be made in Italy. In 191 BC, the Romans declared war against Antiochus and started an army into Greece. Antiochus seized Thermopylae and added fortifications to its natural strength, but strangely enough, set no efficient guard upon the path that led over the mountains, and the Romans sent a part of their army over that path to the east, as Xerxes in his campaign had sent over it to the west. The result was now the same as then. The forces of Magnus, attacked both in front and rear, were soon put to flight, and a great number of them perished. Antiochus, with such of his army as escaped, made his way back to the Hellespont and crossed into Asia as soon as possible. He then went to Ephesus, and there settled down at ease, assuring himself, and being also assured by his courtiers, that the Romans, being satisfied with having driven him out of Europe, would never follow him into Asia. Hannibal, however, constantly urged that the Romans would come into Asia against him, and that he would be compelled shortly to fight both by sea and land in Asia and for Asia. He was at last sufficiently aroused to fortify some cities on both sides of the Hellespont to prevent the Romans from crossing, and to resolve to venture a naval engagement. His fleet was manned and sent out from Ephesus into the Aegean Sea to find the Roman fleet and attack it. They did so and were badly defeated by the Romans, 191 BC. As early as possible in the spring of 190 BC, the Romans were active again both by land and sea. Macedonia was by this time so entirely subject to the Roman power that even Philip with his army supported the Romans against Antiochus. Hannibal had been sent to Syria and Phoenicia to bring to Antiochus at Ephesus the fleets of those countries. The Rhodians, who had joined the Romans, met Hannibal as he was on his way with the fleet and succeeded in defeating him near Patara and shutting him up so closely as to make it impossible for either him or his fleet to be of any service to Antiochus. The news of this defeat reached Antiochus at the same time that word came to him that the Roman army was advancing by forced marches prepared to pass the Hellespont. He decided that the only way to prevent the Roman army from entering Asia was to wipe out the Roman fleet and then, being in control of the sea, sail with his fleet to the Hellespont and dispute its passage. But at his first attempt to regain possession of the sea, he suffered a worse defeat than before. This so disconcerted him that he hurried away messengers to recall all his forces from the western side of the Hellespont. This was only to surrender to the Romans all his fortified cities there, and such a move could not, by any possible means, help to keep the Romans out of Asia. The Romans shortly came on, and were much pleased to find these fortified cities not only undefended, but containing large quantities of provisions and implements of war. Then, without meeting any opposition whatever, they conveyed the whole army over the Hellespont and marched to Troy, where, 190 BC, they and the Trojans grandly celebrated the arrival of the Romans upon the spot from which Aeneas, their progenitor, had set out on his lonely journey so long, long before. When Antiochus learned that the Roman army was actually in Asia, he sent an embassy to ask for peace. He proposed that he would lay no claim any more to any possessions in Europe, would give up his Asiatic cities to the Romans, would pay half the expenses of the war, and if the Romans would not be satisfied with Europe alone, he would yield some part of Asia, if only they would clearly define the limits of it. The Romans replied that, as Antiochus had been the occasion of the war, he ought to pay all the expenses, and that it was not enough that he should surrender his cities, but that he must surrender all Asia Minor west of the Taurus Mountains. Antiochus thought that the Romans could not have prescribed harder conditions had they conquered him. Such a peace appeared to him as fatal as the most unfortunate war. He therefore prepared for a battle, as the Romans did also on their side. The battle was fought at Magnesia in Phrygia. The army of Antiochus numbered 70,000 infantry, 12,000 cavalry, and 54 elephants. The Romans had 30,000 men and 16 elephants. The army of Antiochus fought desperately, but all in vain. He was defeated with a loss of 54,000 slain, 1,400 prisoners, and 15 elephants captured. The Romans lost but 324 men. By this victory, the Romans acquired all the cities of Asia Minor, which now submitted voluntarily to them. Antiochus, with such of his forces as remained, made his way as rapidly as possible to his capital at Antioch, and at once sent back from there to the Romans an embassy to sue for peace. They found the Roman consul at Sardis. They did not endeavor to excuse Antiochus in any manner, and only sued humbly in his name for peace, saying, "You have always pardoned with greatness of mind the kings and nations you have conquered. How much more should you be induced to do this after a victory which gives you the empire of the universe? Henceforth, being become equal to the gods, lay aside all animosity against mortals, and make the good of the human race your sole study for the future." When the consul and his council had considered the question, they announced that the terms of the peace would be only those that were offered before the war. These terms, now exactly defined, were that Antiochus should evacuate all Asia west of Mount Taurus, that he pay all the expenses of the war, which were computed at 15,000 euboic talents, $18 million. The payments were to be 500 talents down, 2,500 when the Senate should have ratified the treaty, and the rest in 12 years, 1,000 talents in each year. In addition to this, he was to pay Eumenes, king of Pergamus, 400 talents, with some minor debts which he already owed to that king, and deliver to the Romans 20 hostages, these to be chosen by the Romans themselves. Then, upon all these, they made this further heavy demand: "The Romans cannot persuade themselves that a prince who gives Hannibal refuge is sincerely desirous of peace. They therefore demand that Hannibal be delivered up to them, as also Thoas the Aetolian, who was the chief agent in fomenting this war." All these terms, without any attempt to secure modification, were accepted by Antiochus Magnus. L. Cotta was sent to Rome with the ambassadors of Antiochus to acquaint the Senate with the particulars of the negotiation and to obtain the ratification of it. Eumenes set out at the same time for Rome, whither the ambassadors of the cities of Asia went also. Soon afterward, the 500 talents were paid to the consul at Ephesus. Hostages were given for the remainder of the payment, and to secure the other articles of the treaty. Antiochus, one of the king's sons, was included among the hostages. He afterward ascended the throne, and was surnamed Epiphanes. The instant Hannibal and Thoas received advice that a treaty was negotiating, concluding that they should be the victims, they provided for their own safety by retiring before it was concluded. With the day of Magnesia, Asia was erased from the list of great states, and never perhaps did a great power fall so rapidly, so thoroughly, and so ignominiously as the kingdom of the Seleucidae under this Antiochus Magnus. It alone, of all the great states conquered by Rome, never after the first conquest made a second appeal to the decision of arms. In the year 187 BC, Antiochus Magnus was murdered by the people of the province of Elymas, because driven by stress of collecting the tribute for the Romans, he had robbed their temple of all its treasures. He was succeeded by his eldest son, Seleucus Philopater, but his reign was obscure and contemptible, occasioned by the misery to which the Romans had reduced that crown, and the exorbitant sum, 1,000 talents, or $1,200,000 annually, he was obliged to pay during the whole of his reign by virtue of the treaty of peace concluded between the king his father and that people. This man attempted to rob the temple of God at Jerusalem, and sent his chief officer Heliodorus to accomplish the robbery. Upon his arrival at Jerusalem and approach to the temple, immediately the whole city was seized with the utmost terror. The priests, dressed in their sacerdotal vestments, fell prostrate at the foot of the altar, beseeching the God of heaven, who enacted the law with regard to deposits, to preserve those laid up in his temple. Great numbers flocked in crowds and jointly besought the Creator upon their knees not to suffer so holy a place to be profaned. The women and maidens, covered with sackcloth, were seen lifting up their hands to heaven. It was a spectacle truly worthy of compassion to see such multitudes, and especially the high priest, pierced with the deepest affliction under the apprehension of so impious a sacrilege. By this time Heliodorus with his guards was come to the gate of the treasury, and preparing to break it open. But the Spirit of the Almighty revealed himself by the most sensible marks, insomuch that all those who had dared to obey Heliodorus were struck down by a divine power, and seized with a terror which bereaved them of all their faculties. For there appeared to them a horse richly caparisoned, which, rushing at once upon Heliodorus, struck him several times with his forefeet. The man who sat on this horse had a terrible aspect, and his arms seemed of gold. At the same time there were seen two young men, whose beauty dazzled the eye, and who, standing on each side of Heliodorus, scourged him incessantly and in the most violent manner. Heliodorus, falling to the ground, was taken up and put into his litter, and this man, who a moment before had come into the temple followed by a great train of guards, was forced away from this holy place and had no one to succor him. And that because the power of God had displayed itself in the strongest manner. By the same power he was cast to the ground speechless and without the least sign of life, whilst the temple, which before resounded with nothing but lamentations, now echoed with the shouts of all the people, who returned thanks to the Almighty for having raised the glory of his holy temple by the effect of his power. But now some of Heliodorus's friends besought the high priest to invoke God in his favor. Immediately Onias offered a sacrifice for his health. Whilst he was praying, the two young men above mentioned appeared to Heliodorus and said to him, "Return thanks to Onias the high priest, for it is for his sake that the Lord has granted you life. After having been chastened of God, declare unto the whole world his miraculous power." Having spoken these words, they vanished. Heliodorus offered up sacrifices and made solemn vows to him who had restored him to life. He returned thanks to Onias and went his way, declaring to everyone the wonderful works of the Almighty, to which he himself had been an eyewitness. The king, asking him whether he believed that another person might be sent with safety to Jerusalem, he answered, "In case you have an enemy or any traitorous wretch who has a design upon your crown, send him thither, and you will see him return back flayed with scourging, if indeed he return at all. For he who inhabiteth the heavens is himself present in that place. He is the guardian and protector of it, and he strikes those mortally who go thither to injure it." The protectorate of the Roman community now embraced all the states, from the eastern to the western end of the Mediterranean. There nowhere existed a state that the Romans would have deemed it worthwhile to fear. But there still lived a man to whom Rome accorded this rare honor, the homeless Carthaginian who had raised in arms against Rome, first all the west and then all the east, and whose schemes had been frustrated, solely perhaps by infamous aristocratic policy in the one case and by stupid court policy in the other. Antiochus had been obliged to bind himself in the treaty of peace to deliver up Hannibal. But the latter had escaped, first to Crete, then to Bithynia, and now lived at the court of Prusias, king of Bithynia, employed in aiding the latter in his wars with Eumenes, king of Pergamus, and victorious as ever by sea and by land. Flamininus, whose restless vanity sought after new opportunities for great achievements, undertook on his own part to deliver Rome from Hannibal as he had delivered the Greeks from their chains, and, if not to wield, which was not diplomatic, at any rate to whet and to point the dagger against the greatest man of his time. Prusias, the most pitiful among the pitiful princes of Asia, was delighted to grant the little favor which the Roman envoy in ambiguous terms requested. And when Hannibal saw his house beset by assassins, he took poison. He had long been prepared to do so, adds a Roman, for he knew the Romans and the faith of kings. The year of his death is uncertain. Probably he died in the latter half of the year 571, of Rome, 183 B.C., at the age of 67. When he was born, Rome was contending with doubtful success for the possession of Sicily. He had lived long enough to see the West wholly subdued, and to fight his own last battle with the Romans against the vessels of his native city, which had itself become Roman. And he was constrained at last to remain a mere spectator while Rome overpowered the East as the tempest overpowers the ship that has no one at the helm, and to feel that he alone was the pilot that could have weathered the storm. There was left to him no further hope to be disappointed when he died. But he had honestly, through 50 years of struggle, kept the oath which he had sworn when a boy. About the same time, probably in the same year, died also the man whom the Romans were wont to call his conqueror, Publius Scipio. On him fortune had lavished all the successes which she had denied to his antagonist, successes which did belong to him and successes which did not. He had added to the empire Spain, Africa, and Asia, and Rome, which he had found merely the first community in Italy, was at his death the mistress of the civilized world. He himself had so many titles of victory that some of them were made over to his brother and his cousin. And yet he too spent his last years in bitter vexation, and died when little more than 50 years of age in voluntary banishment, leaving orders to his relatives not to bury his remains in the city for which he had lived and in which his ancestors reposed. Soon after this, Seleucus Philopater, desiring to have his brother Antiochus Epiphanes with him in the kingdom, sent his only son to Rome as hostage in place of Antiochus. This move caused the two heirs to the crown to be absent from the kingdom, and upon this happening, Heliodorus poisoned Seleucus and seized the kingdom. Antiochus Epiphanes, however, secured the aid of Eumenes, king of Pergamus, and easily expelled Heliodorus and took the throne that belonged to him by the death of Seleucus Philopater, 175 B.C. He assumed the title of Epiphanes, that is, illustrious, which title was never worse applied. The whole series of his life will show that he deserved much more that of Epimenes, mad or furious, which some people gave him. In the year 173, Epiphanes, in sending his annual tribute to Rome, was obliged to make excuses to the Senate for having sent the tribute later than was stipulated by the treaty. By his ambassador, he also asked that the alliance and friendship which had been granted his father should be renewed with him, and desired that the Romans would give him such orders as suited a king who valued himself on being their affectionate and faithful ally, and that he could never forget the great favors he had received from the Senate, from all the youths of Rome, and from persons of all ranks and conditions during his abode in that city, where he had been treated not merely as a hostage, but as a monarch. In the year 171, the Romans were obliged to engage in a war with Perseus, the son of Philip, king of Macedon. Antiochus Epiphanes, taking advantage of this engagement of the Roman forces, attempted to seize Egypt. Though the young Ptolemy was now of an age to reign in his own right, and was also nephew to Epiphanes. In the meantime, to observe measures with the Romans, he sent ambassadors to the Senate to represent the right he had to the provinces of Coele-Syria and Palestine, of which he was actually possessed, and the necessity he was under of engaging in a war in order to support that right, immediately after which he put himself at the head of his army and marched toward the frontiers of Egypt. Ptolemy's army came up with his near Mount Cassius and Pelusium, and a battle was fought in which Antiochus was victorious. He made so good a use of his success that he put the frontier in a condition to serve as a barrier and to check the utmost efforts the Egyptians might make to recover those provinces. In this year, however, he made no further progress toward Egypt, but led his army back to Tyre and spent the whole winter in strengthening his forces and making preparations for the invasion of Egypt the following year. Early in the spring of 170, he invaded Egypt by both land and sea. Young Ptolemy raised such an army as he could, but was unable to save his country from invasion. A battle was fought at the frontier, but the Egyptians were defeated, and the city of Pelusium was captured, and Antiochus Epiphanes marched into the very heart of Egypt. In this last defeat of the Egyptians, it was in his power not to have suffered a single man to escape, but the more completely to ruin his nephew, instead of making use of the advantage he had gained, he himself rode up and down on all sides and obliged his soldiers to discontinue the slaughter. This clemency gained him the hearts of the Egyptians, and when he advanced into the country, all the inhabitants came in crowds to pay their submission to him, so that he soon took Memphis and all the rest of Egypt except Alexandria, which alone held out against him. Philometor, was either taken or else surrendered himself to Antiochus, who set him at full liberty. After this, they had but one table, lived seemingly in great friendship, and for some time Antiochus affected to be extremely careful of the interests of the young king, his nephew, and to regulate his affairs as his guardian. But when he had once possessed himself of the country, under that pretext he seized whatever he thought fit, plundered all places, and enriched himself as well as his soldiers with the spoils of the Egyptians. While Antiochus was in Egypt, a false report of his death was spread through Palestine, upon which a certain Jason marched against Jerusalem with about 1,000 men, and with the assistance of certain partisans in the city, captured it. When news of this was brought to Antiochus in Egypt, he hastily concluded that the Jews had made a general insurrection, and marched at once to Jerusalem, laid siege to it, took it by storm, and gave it up to sack and slaughter for 3 days, in which about 80,000 people were slain, 40,000 were made prisoners, and about 40,000 were sold as slaves. He also entered the temple, and even into the Holy of Holies, which he polluted, being guided by the traitor Menelaus. And when he departed, he took with him the altar of incense, the table for the showbread, and the candlestick, as well as a large share of the other golden utensils of the temple. He appointed as governor of Judea a certain Phrygian named Philip, a man of great cruelty. He nominated Andronicus, a man of the like barbarous disposition, governor of Samaria, and bestowed on Menelaus, the most wicked of the three, the title of high priest, investing him with the authority annexed to the office. The people of Alexandria, as we have seen, had not submitted to Antiochus Epiphanes. And when they saw his nephew, the young Ptolemy Philometor, in his hands, as they supposed permanently, they took Ptolemy's younger brother, Ptolemy Euergetes, and made him king 169 B.C. As soon as Antiochus had learned this, he marched again into Egypt under the spacious pretense of restoring the dethroned monarch, but in reality to make himself absolute master of the kingdom. He defeated the Alexandrians in a sea fight near Pelusium, marched his forces into Egypt, and advanced directly toward Alexandria in order to besiege it. In a great council that was called, it was decided to send an embassy to Antiochus to make peace, if possible. Antiochus received the embassy very graciously and pretended to a joint agreement, but postponed the actual settlement of conditions and the conclusion of peace, stating at the same time that he would do nothing without their knowledge and cooperation. The purpose of this, however, was only to disarm the leaders in behalf of the new king, and when this was accomplished, Antiochus marched directly to Alexandria and laid siege to it. In this extremity, Ptolemy Euergetes and Cleopatra, his sister, who were in the city, sent ambassadors to Rome, representing the deplorable condition to which they were reduced, and imploring the aid of the Romans. The ambassadors appeared, in the audience to which they were admitted by the Senate, with all the marks of sorrow used at that time in the greatest afflictions, and made a speech still more affecting. They observed that the authority of the Romans was so much revered by all nations and kings, and that Antiochus particularly had received so many obligations from them, that if they would only declare by their ambassadors that the Senate did not approve of his making war against kings in alliance with Rome, they did not doubt but Antiochus would immediately draw off his troops from Alexandria, and return to Syria. That should the Senate refuse to afford them their protection, Ptolemy and Cleopatra, being expelled from their kingdom, would be immediately reduced to fly to Rome, and that it would reflect a dishonor on the Romans to have neglected to aid the king and queen at a time when their affairs were so desperate. The Senate moved with their remonstrances and persuaded that it would not be for the interest of the Romans to suffer Antiochus to attain to such a height of power, and that he would be too formidable should he unite the crown of Egypt to that of Syria, resolved to send an embassy to Egypt to put an end to the war. C. Papilius Linus, C. Decimus, and C. Hostilius were appointed for this important negotiation. Their instructions were that they should first wait upon Antiochus, and afterward on Ptolemy, should order them in the name of the Senate to suspend all hostilities and put an end to the war, and that should either of the parties refuse compliance, the Romans would no longer consider them as their friend or ally. As the danger was imminent, 3 days after the resolution had been taken in the Senate, they set out from Rome with the Egyptian ambassadors. Meantime, Antiochus had raised the siege of Alexandria and returned to his capital at Antioch, still retaining, however, full possession of Pelusium, the key of Egypt. Then the two brothers, Ptolemy Philometor and Ptolemy Euergetes, came to terms and united their interests in hope to withstand Antiochus and save Egypt. As soon as Antiochus learned of this understanding of the brothers Ptolemy, he resolved, 168 BC, to employ his whole force against them. Accordingly, he sent his fleet early into Cyprus to preserve the possession of that island. At the same time, he marched at the head of a powerful army with the design to conquer Egypt openly, and not pretend, as he had before done, to fight the cause of one of his nephews, but to make an absolute conquest of the whole kingdom. He penetrated as far as Memphis, subjecting the whole country through which he passed, and there received the submission of almost all the rest of the kingdom. He afterward marched toward Alexandria, with the design to besiege that city, the possession of which would have made him absolute master of all Egypt. He would certainly have succeeded in his enterprise had he not been checked in his career by the Roman embassy, which broke all the measures he had been so long taking in order to possess himself of Egypt. Thus the king of the north came and cast up a mount and took the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south could not withstand, neither was there any strength to withstand. We before observed that the ambassadors who were nominated to go to Egypt had left Rome with the utmost diligence. They landed at Alexandria just at the time Antiochus was marching to besiege it. The ambassadors came up with him at Eleusine, which was not a mile from Alexandria. The king, seeing Papilius, with whom he had been intimately acquainted at Rome when he was a hostage in that city, opened his arms to embrace him as his old friend. The Roman, who did not consider himself on that occasion as a private man, but a servant of the public, desired to know before he answered his compliment whether he spoke to a friend or an enemy of Rome. He then gave him the decree of the Senate, bade him read it over, and return him an immediate answer. Antiochus, after perusing it, said he would examine the contents of it with his friends and give his answer in a short time. Papilius, enraged at the king for talking of delays, drew with the wand he had in his hand a circle around Antiochus, and then raising his voice said, "Answer the Senate before you stir out of that circle." The king, quite confounded at so haughty an order, after a moment's reflection, replied that he would act according to the desire of the Senate. Papilius then received his civilities and behaved afterward in all respects as an old friend. How important was the effect of this blunt loftiness of sentiment and expression! The Roman, with a few words, strikes terror into the king of Syria and saves the king of Egypt. Antiochus, having left Egypt at the time stipulated, Papilius returned with his colleagues to Alexandria, where he brought to a conclusion the treaty of union between the two brothers, which had hitherto been but slightly sketched out. He then crossed to Cyprus, sent home Antiochus's fleet, which had gained victory over that of the Egyptians, restored the whole island to the kings of Egypt, who had a just claim to it, and returned to Rome in order to acquaint the Senate with the success of his embassy. Ambassadors from Antiochus and the two Ptolemies and Cleopatra, their sister, arrived there almost at the same time. The former said that the peace which the Senate had been pleased to grant their sovereign appeared to him more glorious than the most splendid conquests, and that he had obeyed the commands of the Roman ambassadors as strictly as if they had been sent from the gods. Egypt voluntarily submitted to the Roman protectorate, and thereupon the kings of Babylon also desisted from the last effort to maintain their independence against Rome. Thus, when the king of the north had come and cast up a mount, and had taken the most fenced cities, and when the arms of the south could not withstand, and there was no strength to withstand, then he, Rome, that came against him, Antiochus, the king of the north, did do according to his own will. The circumstance which made the Roman Papilius so bold as to draw a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes and bid him answer before he stepped out of it, and which made Epiphanes so submissive as to comply with such a narrow condition, was the news that arrived just before of the great victory gained by the Romans over Perseus, king of Macedonia. This victory, which destroyed the kingdom of Macedonia and added that country finally to the Roman Empire, was gained in the Battle of Pydna, June 22, 168 BC. Thus perished the empire of Alexander the Great, which had subdued and Hellenized the East 144 years after his death. All the Hellenistic states had thus been completely subjected to the protectorate of Rome, and the whole empire of Alexander the Great had fallen to the Roman Commonwealth, just as if the city had inherited it from his heirs. From all sides, kings and ambassadors flocked to Rome to congratulate her, and they showed that fawning is never more abject than when kings are in the antechamber. The moment was at least well chosen for such homage. Polybius dates from the Battle of Pydna the full establishment of the Empire of Rome. It was, in fact, the last battle in which a civilized state confronted Rome in the field on a footing of equality with her as a great power. All subsequent struggles were rebellions, or wars with peoples beyond the pale of the Romano-Greek civilization, the barbarians, as they were called. The whole civilized world thenceforth recognized in the Roman Senate the supreme tribunal, whose commissioners decided in the last resort between kings and nations, and to acquire its language and manners, foreign princes and youths of quality resided in Rome. As for Macedonia, by the Roman Senate it was decreed in particular that the Macedonians and Illyrians should be declared free, in order that all nations might know that the end of the Roman arms was not to subject free people, but to deliver such as were enslaved, so that the one, under the protection of the Roman name, might always retain their liberty, and the other, who were under the rule of kings, might be treated with more lenity and justice by them, through consideration for the Romans. Or that, whenever war should arise between those kings and the Roman people, the nations might know that the issue of those wars would be victory for the Romans and liberty for them. The reader begins to discover, in the events related, one of the principal characteristics of the Romans, which will soon determine the fate of all the states of Greece and produce an almost general change in the universe. I mean a spirit of sovereignty and dominion. This characteristic does not display itself at first in its full extent. It reveals itself only by degrees, and it is only by insensible progressions, which at the same time are rapid enough, that it is carried at last to its greatest height. It must be confessed that this people, on certain occasions, show such a moderation and disinterestedness as, judging of them only from their outside, exceed everything we meet with in history, and to which it seems inconsistent to refuse praise. Was there ever a more delightful or more glorious day than that in which the Romans, after having carried on a long and dangerous war, after crossing seas and exhausting their treasures, caused a herald to proclaim in a general assembly that the Roman people restored all the cities to their liberty and desired to reap no other fruit from their victory than the noble pleasure of doing good to nations, the bare remembrance of whose ancient glory sufficed to endear them to the Romans? The description of what passed on that immortal day can hardly be read without tears and without being affected with a kind of enthusiasm of esteem and admiration. Had this deliverance of the Grecian states proceeded from a principle of generosity, void of all interested motives, had the whole tenor of the conduct of the Romans never belied such exalted sentiments, nothing could possibly have been more august or more capable of doing honor to a nation. But if we penetrate ever so little beyond this glaring outside, we soon perceive that this spacious moderation of the Romans was entirely founded upon a profound policy, wise indeed and prudent according to the ordinary rules of government, but at the same time very remote from that noble disinterestedness which has been so highly extolled on the present occasion. It may be affirmed that the Grecians then abandoned themselves to a stupid joy, fondly imagining that they were really free because the Romans declared them so. Greece, in the times I am now speaking of, was divided between two powers. I mean the Grecian republics and Macedonia. And they were always engaged in war, the former to preserve the remains of their ancient liberty, and the latter to complete their subjection. The Romans, being perfectly well acquainted with this state of Greece, were sensible that they needed not to be under any apprehensions from those little republics, which were grown weak through length of years, intestine feuds, mutual jealousies, and the wars they had been forced to support against foreign powers. Therefore, the Romans declared loudly in favor of those republics, made it their glory to take them under their protection, and that with no other design in outward appearance than to defend them against their oppressors, and, further, to attach them by still stronger ties, they held out to them a spacious bait as a reward for their fidelity, I mean liberty, of which all the republics in question were inexpressibly jealous, and which the Macedonian monarchs had perpetually disputed with them. The bait was artfully prepared, and swallowed very greedily by the generality of the Greeks, whose views penetrated no further. But the most judicious and most clear-sighted among them discovered the danger that lay beneath this charming bait, and accordingly they exhorted the people from time to time in their public assemblies to beware of this cloud that was gathering in the west, and which, changing on a sudden into a dreadful tempest, would break like thunder over their heads to their utter destruction. Nothing could be more gentle and equitable than the conduct of the Romans in the beginning. They acted with the utmost moderation towards such states and nations as addressed them for protection. They succored them against their enemies, took the utmost pains in terminating their differences and in suppressing all commotions which arose amongst them, and did not demand the least recompense from their allies for all these services. By this means, their authority gained strength daily and prepared the nations for entire subjection. And indeed, under pretense of offering them their good offices, of entering into their interests, and of reconciling them, the Romans rendered themselves the sovereign arbiters of those whom they had restored to liberty, and whom they now considered in some measure as their freedmen. They used to depute commissioners to them, to inquire into their complaints, to weigh and examine the reasons on both sides, and to decide their quarrels. But when the articles were of such a nature that there was no possibility of reconciling them on the spot, they invited them to send their deputies to Rome. Afterward, they used, with plenary authority, to summon those who refused to come to an agreement, oblige them to plead their cause before the Senate, and even to appear in person there. From arbiters and mediators, being become supreme judges, they soon assumed a magisterial tone, looked upon their decrees as irrevocable decisions, were greatly offended when the most implicit obedience was not paid to them, and gave the name of rebellion to a second resistance. Thus there arose in the Roman Senate a tribunal which judged all nations and kings, and from which there was no appeal. This tribunal, at the end of every war, determined the rewards and punishments due to all parties. They dispossessed the vanquished nations of part of their territories in order to bestow them on their allies, by which they did two things from which they reaped a double advantage. For they thereby engaged in the interest of Rome such kings as were no ways formidable to them, and from whom they had something to hope, and weakened others whose friendship the Romans could not expect, and whose arms they had reason to dread. We shall hear of one of the chief magistrates in the Republic of the Achaeans inveigh strongly in a public assembly against this unjust usurpation, and ask by what title the Romans were empowered to assume so haughty an ascendant over them, whether their republic was not as free and independent as that of Rome, by what right the latter pretended to force the Achaeans to account for their conduct, whether they would be pleased, should the Achaeans in their turn, officially pretend to inquire into their affairs, and whether matters ought not to be on the same footing on both sides. All these reflections were very reasonable, just, and unanswerable, and the Romans had no advantage in the question but force. They acted in the same manner, and their politics were the same with regard to their treatment of kings. They first won over to their interest such among them as were the weakest, and consequently the least formidable. They gave them the title of allies, whereby their persons were rendered in some measure sacred and inviolable, and which was a kind of safeguard against other kings more powerful than themselves. They increased their revenue, and enlarge their territories, to let them see what they might expect from their protection. It was this which raised the kingdom of Pergamos to so exalted a pitch of grandeur. In the sequel, the Romans invaded, upon different pretenses, those great potentates who divided Europe and Asia. And how haughtily did they treat them, even before they had conquered? A powerful king confined within a narrow circle by a private man of Rome was obliged to make his answer before he quitted it. How imperious was this! But then, how did they treat vanquished kings? They command them to deliver up their children and the heirs to their crown as hostages and pledges of their fidelity and good behavior, oblige them to lay down their arms, forbid them to declare war or conclude any alliance without first obtaining their leave, banish them to the other side of the mountains and leave them, in strictness of speech, only an empty title and a vain shadow of royalty divested of all its rights and advantages. We cannot doubt but that Providence had decreed to the Romans the sovereignty of the world, and the Scriptures had prophesied their future grandeur, but they were strangers to those divine oracles, and besides, the bare prediction of their conquests was no justification of their conduct. Although it is difficult to affirm, and still more so to prove, that this people had from the first formed a plan in order to conquer and subject all nations, it cannot be denied but that, if we examine their whole conduct attentively, it will appear that they acted as if they had a foreknowledge of this, and that a kind of instinct had determined them to conform to it in all things. But be this as it will, we see by the event in what this so much boasted lenity and moderation of the Romans terminated. Enemies to the liberty of all nations, having the utmost contempt for kings and monarchy, looking upon the whole universe as their prey, they grasped with insatiable ambition the conquests of the whole world. They seized indiscriminately all provinces and kingdoms, and extended their empire over all nations. In a word, they prescribed no other limits to their vast projects than those which deserts and seas made it impossible to pass. Daniel, while he lived in Babylon, 606 to 534 BC, had written that in the latter time of the kingdoms that succeeded to the great dominion of Alexander the Great, a power of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences should stand up, that his power would be mighty, but not by his own power, that it would destroy wonderfully and prosper and practice, that through his policy he would cause craft to prosper in his hand, that by peace he would destroy many, and that he would devour and break in pieces and stamp the residue with his feet. And so, in Rome, it came to pass.